All right, guys, and welcome back to Drunkenomics, the drinking podcast with an economics problem. I am your solo host this week, James Goldwater. Aaron, I think, had too much fun in Boston, and I don't know where he is. So if anyone does have a clue or an idea about where Aaron is, please, please join us on the social media if you haven't already, and let me know there. So if you don't know where that is, but you do know where Aaron is, or if you just need a reminder, that's at Drunken Uncle, DRUNKENOMICAL, on all socials. So that's in the former metaverse, so on Facebook and Instagram, and of course on Twitter, a totally unrelated and unconnected social media platform. If you don't feel comfortable talking to me there about it or DMing us there, because maybe they have Aaron's phone, jump into the Discord. You should find an invite on any of those, free to all, and there you can drop your hint about where Aaron may or may not be, or at least your important information that we might need to know. As such, without Aaron, it's going to be kind of a weird week. Some crazy stuff's happened since we went on vacation, right? So I say vacation. We went on a hangover. We went and had some fun. So it's been it really has been a wild week. So we have, for the second time in, 2 months, the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, right? So with the collapse of First Republic Bank, which, you know, wasn't doing so well. They bought SVB, which was, prior to the acquisition, the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, right? So I guess they bought them and decided they were going to outdo it after the buy. And then they, of course, have now been purchased up by, well, now I probably should have checked that in the note. And so, of course, First Republic was then purchased up by JP Morgan Chase, which was kind of a surprise, because I think a lot of us were expecting a different player to come in and make the buy. So that was a bit of a shock. Not necessarily that they were purchased and sold, but that who it was. I had money on PNC Bank personally. I think that's who was looking better going into that weekend. So on top of that, yes, we had some bank failures. We had a Fed meeting where we did see the 25 basis points we fully expected to, right? So we'd said that we expected to see 25 basis points. And at this point, we'll see how that looks, how that compares to what inflation is doing, which we received that information today. So this week, and we know that inflation did come in at 4.9%, right? So it's down. It's under 5% for the first time in 2 years, which is pretty wild to think about in the U.S., where like inflation has historically been around 2%, or at least in the last 20 to 30 years, it's been around 2%. And now it's at 5 or just under 5, but it's been over 5 for the last 2 years, which is, you know, not insubstantial, but I think it was less than they were hoping for, right? So we were at 4.9%, which is down from 5% in March. So this is April compared, which is down from, I think, 8.3% or 8.4% last year. So this time last year. So we've seen pretty drastic improvement year over year. We're seeing slight improvement month over month. It's something like the 10th month in a row, or the but we're seeing that inflation, yeah, for the 10th month in a row, a decrease in inflation, right? So a decrease in the increase in inflation, right? So inflation, right, is the increase in prices. Prices are still going up, but by a smaller amount, right? So we're seeing that the rise in prices is slowing, which is what we're seeing with this 4.9%. But that also means, for those of you that are paying attention or quicker than me, or that your brain just immediately went there when you went, wait, 4.9% inflation, 5.25% interest rate. That's it, folks. We finally did it. We got there. We got to a non-negative real interest rate. And now we get to see what that does. It will be, it should be. And now we get to see what that real non-negative interest rate is. We'll see if people decide to take their foot off the gas, right? So now you can actually put your money away, at least assuming that inflation stays where it is or continues to decrease the increase, right? So, or continues to slow the increase. We can now put our money away at the risk-free rate. Well, if we can put our money away at the risk-free rate and we can see actual growth, we don't lose buying power over time, right? So that's why a non-negative real interest rate is so important because it finally tells you, well, you don't have to spend your money to prevent from losing buying power. It should allow people to draw their money out of purchases, out of consumption being the huge driver of inflation, or at least the huge driver in inflation in the goods that you're probably usually going after because they are consumable goods, right? 70% of the US economy, consumable goods, probably what affects you every day. Jumping. Seeing interest rates. I guess I'll kind of go back. So those of you that are also wondering, hey, why did First Republic Bank fail? You know, it bought up SVB. It has $30 billion in gimme loans from the big banks, including JPMorgan Chase was one of the big banks that put a chunk of that $30 billion in deposits in. Why did they fail? And the answer is very simple. There was probably already a bit of a depositor flight underway from First Republic, right? So banks want the vast majority of the liabilities on their books to be from deposits. So for those of you that don't know, when a bank takes your cash, they put your cash as an asset on the balance sheet. They view your short-term deposit or they view your checking account deposit as a liability because you have the right, the absolute right to turn up and take that from them on a whim, and they have to make good. The banks like that, it's cheap money. They don't have to pay you very much compared to, say, borrowing from the Fed overnight, from borrowing from a different bank or a money market overnight to offset to keep their liquidity in place to back a loan. So the big thing, they were probably looking at a bit of a capital flight, which is to say that depositors were pulling money. So depositor flight versus a capital flight. They, in doing this, they saw something, and I think it was something along the lines of about $80 billion, but it was at least $40 billion over the course of the quarter in deposits leave the bank. So when you have something like $150 billion in deposits and at least $40 billion walks out the door, a third of your deposits or cheap money to make loans against is gone. You have to make up that hole somewhere, and they had to do it through more expensive overnight programs, more expensive borrowing from mutual funds, or not mutual funds, but money markets. And that created or eliminated a lot of their ability to make money. I remember their servicing also every loan that they've issued at a historically lower interest rate, or especially if that interest rate is paying out lower than the 4.9% inflation that we're currently seeing, means that the bank, you're actually losing money as a bank. What they're paying you back with is worth less than a dollar now, right? So there's a great discussion you always have in like your intro to macroeconomics classes, or at least Aaron and I both had the same discussion. And then as you go through more macroeconomics, you have the discussion there. But it's a very simple concept, is that if you can borrow money at an interest rate that is below the inflationary rate, or rather you should say, you never want to loan money at an interest rate below inflation, because you're doubly losing money. You're not getting, you're getting paid back in dollars that are worth less than if you hadn't made the loan at all. So it's a bad thing to be as a creditor. As a borrower, if you can get that really low interest rate and have an inflation rate that's higher than that, that's probably a good thing for you, because you pay back in dollars that are worth less in terms of buying power. So it's a great way to make a deal. It's like, there's a great discussion I once had with Dave Fiala about Bitcoin and other cryptos, which none of us, or at least the two of us, don't agree on that, or don't agree with the concept of it being a viable currency. But we talk about how, you know, if you could buy a car for one Bitcoin, but now a car is worth only a quarter of a Bitcoin. Why did you buy it for one Bitcoin? This is, it's a terrible decision, right? You wouldn't want to buy with something that's losing that much value, i.e. the car is losing value that quickly. Another thing that happened this weekend, for those of you that are in and around Omaha, Nebraska, you know that it was shareholder weekend, stockholder weekend. So that's the best day of the week. It's where Warren and Charlie Munger and some of the other guys out of Berkshire Hathaway sit down with their shareholders to kind of discuss the year. They answer questions. They also, and it's a pretty consistent offer, is that if they bring in a bear, they offer to bring in a bear every year, someone who's bet against Warren Buffett, someone who's bet against, or who's betting against Berkshire Hathaway, someone who has a proven track record of bear positions against them, who's making money, who's making money, to come in and contest them, or to also give an opposite opinion to what they're saying. That's always very exciting. They're, you know, it kind of, Omaha goes wild, if you can imagine that, for something that isn't college World Series baseball. So I know that he kind of came out, and, or at least Warren kind of came out and said that it just kind of the big deal in investment is that often now what you aren't trying to bet against a company or for a company. The way you really make money now is because of the tightening of spreads, which is to say computers and fast transactions, and the fact that the data is all available. What you'd say is that now what you're really waiting for, the only way to make huge amounts of money in shrewd trades, is that you have to bet against someone, right? So you have to be in the right side of someone else's mistake. So someone sells right before a price pops, someone buys, or someone's willing to buy from you right before a price crash, right? It's that greater fool. The greater fool argument is to say is there's someone who's willing to take on or unload from a position when they shouldn't, and you are sitting there to profit from the greater fool, right? They are a fool. You are a fool because you bought into this position, which now may or may not work out, but there's a greater fool than you. You leave them holding the hat, and there's just a, again, another newsroom reference. If you watch, there's the one, the great Olivia, when it's Olivia Munn talking, and she just goes, the greater fool, it's an economic term. They're the person, you throw them the hot potato, you dive for their seat when the music stops, right? It's the person, it's just the person you're trying to beat. It's the entire rationale now in the stock market being is, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you. I just can't be the slowest person in the group. It's not necessarily the kindest view to have, but it's cutthroat out there. You're there to make money. And while the stock market as a whole is a non-zero-sum game, aspects of the stock market are very zero-sum games. And I know Aaron and I want to talk about this in more detail later, but it's this very entertaining side that, like, derivatives are zero-sum, but the securities they might be derivatives of are non-zero-sum. And how, on top of that derivative, so you might be sitting here looking at, you know, a lot of options. They're not all zero-sum, but if the options market works logically, and if it were a closed environment, the options market would also be zero sum. But because it is open to human error and external pressures, technically the options market becomes a non-zero sum game, in that, for those of you wondering, zero sum versus non-zero sum, zero sum game is there's a finite number of points. In order for me to win, you have to lose. A non-zero sum game is we can both win, or we can both lose. It's not that my gain doesn't have to come from your loss. And your loss doesn't inevitably create gain for me. That's the non-zero sum. So it's that I can win and you can also win, and then one of us can win more or less, and then we can both do well, right? So it's not like there's a fixed amount of money like there is in options markets. There's essentially a potentially an infinite amount, as long as people keep making money that they're unwilling to buy in, right? So there's a infinite upside to stock markets and a finite downside to securities values, which is to say a penny or basically zero. But I don't think I've ever actually seen something go to zero. I've seen options go to negatives, but that was oil and that was fun. I'm trying to think. Let's see if there are any fun questions in Discord. Of course you're not. Oh no. No. Well, that fucking sucks. Okay. You didn't crash. You just... My screen froze up. Okay, that's good. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess if we... I mean, really, just to jump around, if we're going to keep jumping around, which I'm gonna. Some more things looking at First Republic is on top of the... you did see a depositor flight, which then led to a capital flight. So capital flight is shareholders selling. Obviously, you had people who were sitting there looking at the fact, you know, people who were owning and going, well, I'm seeing deposits leave, or I'm seeing the bank put itself in a position where it's not going to be as profitable. I should sell my shares now to that greater fool, right? To the person who's willing to buy. And they did so. And they dumped out in such a way as to say that the stock value fell to zero, or not zero, but it precipitously dropped. It lost huge percentages of its value very, very quickly, all based on the fact that the deposits that were supposed to underpin the business operations of the bank were also flying out. That's why you saw the bank go into receivership. They announced essentially it's going into receivership this weekend, no matter what. The FDIC said, banks, I want to hear your... Or, you know, to other banks, turned around and said, hey, I want to hear your offers. What's your best offer? What's your best bid to buy this? And at that point, you saw JP Morgan, PNC, a few others with the presumptive front runners. They came in, they made their offers. Essentially, the way it worked is the second that they had an offer that the FDIC said, we accept this, Treasury said, okay. Everyone signed off and said, this is fine. The bank was placed in receivership and sold immediately, right? So it wasn't like you're in receivership, we're now looking for a buyer. It's, we're looking for a buyer, you're the buyer, receivership sale, wash is fast. The wash was instant, and it was done to try and stabilize the banking industry. Now, the problem remains is that, again, the solution to SVB was the bank failed, went into receivership and was purchased. The problem for First Republic was once more, the bank failed, it went into receivership, and it was purchased by someone else. Granted, it happened exceptionally quickly, but still, there isn't a solution for these banks being in very bad position. These smaller and mid-sized banks are all in, they're all in really bad shape. Well, they're not all in really bad shape, that's not fair. Let's go back to before that line and not say it. These banks are all in riskier shape because they don't have huge deposits they can count on, right? So you have JP Morgan Chase, which has a huge number of deposits. You have your Wells Fargo, which isn't really able to make plays in these because they're still being bound by by some legal issues they had historically, which kind of prevents them from expanding beyond a certain size in terms of assets and what they're doing, which is why you saw probably in the last year, you would have noticed Wells Fargo has actually pulled out of certain business sectors. They've pulled out of certain aspects of what they do, just going, well, we're going to focus on other core aspects of the business because we're still under this decree. But so, yeah, here we go. Questions, and then I'll probably wrap this up. I guess just to keep harping on banks, why don't I just harp on banks and some of the really interesting things that have happened. So there was this, there's this really funny thing that happened in the whole Credit Suisse. UBS boondoggle, right? So UBS acquired Credit Suisse, the biggest competitor. And as we go into that first period, oh, this is unbelievable. I'm glad I'm harping. I'm glad I'm looking this up because apparently UBS has decided to take in Credit Suisse CEO as the merger closes, right? So they're going to bring in Credit Suisse's CEO onto the executive board, right? They're going to keep the banks operating separately for the foreseeable future, but they will be all owned and essentially overseen by UBS. Now, the very funny thing to me was that actually with this purchase, with this acquisition, UBS had to take a loss in this first half of the year, and that Credit Suisse actually took had a profit in that time as they were selling. And the reason for that is that there are these really interesting bonds that exist in European markets, and it's in a response to 2008. So there are these very interesting, it's a very interesting class of bonds that only exists in Europe. It doesn't exist in the United States. And it's essentially called, I think it's like an FT1 bond or, fucking come on. AT1 bonds, not FT1 bonds. So AT1 bonds, which are created literally for the purpose of being written down in the event of a liquidity crisis at a bank. So these are bonds that, like, legitimately, the entire premise of the AT1 bond is that it is extremely risky. They're called convertible bonds, right? So they're a type of convertible bond. They only exist in Europe, right? So they don't exist in the US. You don't have to worry about them. They exist to be converted at a point, right? So at the bank's behest, right? So the bank can decide when to convert it. So certain, you have convertible bonds in the US, and often that means that depending on the way the bond's conversion is written, right? How the bond is designed. Usually what you have is you have a convertible bond where as a bondholder or a debt holder in that case, you could say, I want to convert my bonds to equity, which puts you technically behind shareholders or, right? So when we look at a liquidation, debtors get paid first, shareholders get paid last, if at all. But then preferred shareholders tend to get paid first. The question at hand now is AT1 bonds, additional tier one bonds, which is what they're called. They're contingent convertible bonds. So the way they operate is that they are a risky way to invest in the bank. They're probably the riskiest way to invest in a bank, but they allow the bank, in the event of a serious financial crisis or the event of a serious liquidity issue, it's allowed to convert those bonds in one of several ways. And so they can convert it to equity, right? And say, okay, you're a shareholder now. You're actually at the back of the line with everyone else to see if you get any of your money back from that you've invested in us. And you get to do it without the joy of getting to have voted for anything prior to this as a shareholder. The AT1s, however, that Credit Suisse owned were completely written down. So written down to zero, they were just written off as if they didn't exist. That's legal. It's part of the way those bonds are allowed to be destroyed. Having said that, a lot of shareholders at this point, because the AT1 bonds were written down to zero, right? They weren't converted to shares. They weren't anything else. They're actually just written off and said, well, we're never going to pay these. Sorry. Hope you enjoyed your coupons that you were definitely getting. And they're going to pay some money to their shareholders as they close. Apparently, some of the original bondholders on the $17 billion in AT1 bonds they held are considering a suit saying, well, as bondholders, we had a legal right to be paid before shareholders. And my response to that is, you invested in something that one of the options is that it can be written down to zero. I don't know how European courts are going to rule, but my non-legalistic response would be, you invested in something really risky. They told you we can write this down to zero in a case, and you accepted it. You went into it, and you know what? Tough. You deal with it. A lot of investors are saying, well, this is actually damaging the entire premise of AT1 bonds. It's going to affect the ability to sell AT1 bonds in the future. And the response to that is kind of, well, yeah, it should. Like, it's extremely risky. Like, it's very much like looking at the U.S. in 2008 or after 2008. And it's this question of, well, gee, are people going to keep investing in the same crazy way on junk bonds, on mortgage backed securities, on the we call it junk bonds in the subprime mortgages? Are they going to? And the answer is, well, yes, of course they are, because of course they did. They're gamblers. They have to. But then the question would be is, but they know, right? There's risk. So it's just one of those things where it's you made an investment, you lost. If you couldn't afford to lose it, you shouldn't have been there in the first place. But that's just a fun one out of, I don't know, just some weird banking stuff that's happened in the last few weeks. Having said that, I don't know. I think, like I said, I think we've got some really fun stuff ahead of us. Some really fun times in the week ahead. We said continuing banking instability. We have continuing reactions. So the market was kind of mixed. It was up, it was down, it was all over the place in reaction to how the stock markets were, or that's how stock markets were reacting to the CPI print, right? So the inflation print, we saw that CPI came in, like I said, at 4.9. It's the increase in inflation is slowing, right? So we're seeing a slowing of the increase, which is good news. We want that. Having said that, I think that this 4.9% will probably drop a bit more in the next read, in the read as we go into next month. Having said that, I think I've said it before. I think we'll have to accept it. I think we're going to be in the 4% range for the foreseeable future. I don't see a reason we wouldn't. And the big one at this point, and it's kind of where my comment from, risk-free rate, if you can get it, is we've got the debt ceiling crisis coming up in, at this point, 20 days, in less than 3 weeks from when I'm recording. In 3 weeks from when you're hearing this, 3 weeks from when I'm recording it, basically, they're going to have to get around the table and try and hash something out that works, because we have a certain former president who said, no, they should run it over the cliff. And my response to that is, that is, if you ever needed any evidence to prove that the man clearly doesn't understand economics, or that anyone doesn't understand economics, anyone who says, default on the national debt for the first time in history and take the risk-free rate to not the risk-free rate, the very basic underpinning of the global economy. Let's destroy the full faith and credit there. That person shouldn't be in charge of anything at all. They shouldn't even be in charge of dumping out a bucket of urine, because they'll probably do it inside. Having said that, I have discovered where Aaron is. He is being held hostage in Boston at a bar. He ran up a hell of a tab, and they said that they won't let him leave. That they're holding him hostage until someone pays his tab off. And so, if you want to help me do that, just go ahead and check us out at drunkonomical.myspreadshop.com. Go ahead and buy some merch, buy some sweet swag, and I promise at least some of that money will go to getting my more gracious and much more fun and entertaining co-host back by next week for you guys. And if you already have too much merch, if you just want to desperately help us as like a J. Paul Getty, help me pay just that ransom real quick, then you can always check us out at patreon.com/drunkenomics, drunkenomics. And like I said, we'll get around there, and we'll get him out of Boston. We'll get him out of that bar. And despite him having a great time, we'll make sure that ransom's paid. Obviously, for those of you that are listening this far, that's an absolute joke. He's not actually being held hostage or for ransom, but he is still, he was busy getting back from Boston. And so that's why it is just me at this point. But I want to say thanks for listening, guys. It's been awesome. It's definitely different without Aaron here to bounce off of for me. So hopefully this isn't too crazy for you guys. And then as we move forward into the week, all I'm going to say is this. If you haven't tried Maku, guys, they're not a sponsor, but it's a very interesting unfiltered rice beer, which has fueled this episode for me. And of course, as we always try to say, going forward into the week, don't forget to play chess, not checkers. Don't brag, just say, And as always, stay drunk and nomical, guys.